Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. In 1974, India surprised the world with Smiling Buddha, a secret underground nuclear test at Pokhran, Rajasthan. India called it a, quote, peaceful nuclear explosion. But few outside of India saw it that way. The 1974 nuclear tests became a symbol of India's ability to help itself, especially given how the country was left out of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, an agreement the country argued was colonial. But as Jovita Sarkar's Plowshares and Swords, India's Nuclear Program in the Global Cold War points out, the country's nuclear program was in fact the product of Cold War tensions and international networks, including some foreign sources of nuclear knowledge and material. Jovita Sarkar is Senior Lecturer in Economic and Social History at the University of Glasgow and the Founding Director of the Global Decolonization Initiative. Today, Jay and I will talk about India's nuclear program from its very beginnings through to when India was brought back into the world's, or at least the U.S.'s, nuclear good graces in 2008. So, Jay, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. You know, perhaps it's best to start kind of like with the big picture, as always. You know, how is India's approach to foreign policy under Nehru, under Indira Gandhi, how is it kind of commonly understood? And what is it about India's nuclear program that complicates this traditional view, this kind of this common wisdom about India's foreign policy?
Yeah. First of all, thank you so much, Nicholas, for inviting me to the podcast. It's very exciting to be able to discuss my book with you and your audience. Great question to start us off. The conventional wisdom about India's foreign policy under Jawaharlal Nehru and his daughter, Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, has been that India's foreign policy has tended to be more prestige-driven and far less related to realpolitik. And scholars over the last 10-15 years using archival evidence to make sense of Indian foreign policy have been gradually dismantling that myth or those set of myths. And so I find in my in the research I did for my book that India's nuclear program really has this important dimension of geopolitics, which this book really deals with. And I find that there is not a lot of difference between how the secular Congress Party and its various iterations were dealing with the nuclear program related question as opposed to the non-Congress parties. So one thing the book, for example, does is discuss that this episode after the emergency when India witnessed the first non-Congress government led by Morarji Desai, his government did not take a radically different position on India's nuclear program and India's relationship with the non-proliferation regime, for example, than the predecessor government of Indira Gandhi or the successor government of Indira Gandhi. So there is more continuity when it comes to different major political parties when it comes to India's nuclear program and their position first. And the second is that this role of geopolitics, which tends to get identified with more of a post-1990s shift in India's foreign policy with the prominence of Hindu nationalist parties, for example, I find that not to be the case. I see geopolitics to be a key dimension of Indian foreign policy throughout. And I also see there is more continuity among the various major political parties when it comes to India's nuclear program.
So your reference to geopolitics, I think, kind of gets at my next question, which is, I mean, your highlighting of geopolitics is kind of presented as like it's a challenge to, again, how India's nuclear program is, again, traditionally understood, perhaps in India. Is there something that we gain from bringing in the international dimension in talking about India's nuclear program that's missing from how, I guess, Indians talk about its nuclear program, how historians talk about the nuclear program? how does bringing in the international dimension help us understand that development?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think the international dimension and the global dimension is really important when we talk about, you know, any national nuclear program in general, whether it is Indian or Israeli or French, because historians like myself who dabble in histories of diplomacy and politics and technologies, we find that the international is omnipresent when it comes to these various networks of scientists or businesses, getting know-how, getting materials, because despite the narratives that we have of national nuclear programs, you know, they cannot be built just as self-contained autarkic systems, because it's just not possible. Even the first successful nuclear program or project, the Manhattan Project, was officially a trilateral endeavor, but in general was an international endeavor, because it would have not been successful without the immigration of scientists and engineers from continental Europe, because nuclear fission was way ahead in continental Europe research-wise than in the United States or the UK or Canada. So I think the international dimension is something that is really important when we talk about any national nuclear program, because these are global endeavors, although they're obviously the state is very important. And as a consequence, it becomes national and nationalistic in narratives. So I think the international dimension in my book with the Indian nuclear program, I see the role of multiple foreign partners. And I find that India's nuclear program was able to maintain on the one hand, the plowshares dimension, which is the nuclear energy or civilian side, and the swords dimension, which is, I call it swords, but essentially the military dimension, through a series of successful foreign partnerships with the French, with the Canadians, with the Americans, to an extent the Soviets. There were these host of foreign partnerships, like hyper diversification of these partnerships, that really helped the leaders of India's nuclear program to maintain multiple choices open at the same time, which I discuss, you know, at the beginning of my book. I frame it as freedom of action. And then I explain it through the various chapters, looking at multiple technological choices that the leaders made and how they were able to make those technological choices. That is through international partnerships. So I think the international partnerships partnerships are a core dimension of all, I would say, all national nuclear programs. And definitely in the Indian case, it helped to maintain multiple options open for the leaders of India's nuclear program, making it this huge polyvalent project serving what I say national security goals as well as national development goals.
So you mentioned kind of India's nuclear leaders, and I want to ask a question about one of them, specifically Homi Bhabha. Kind of, he's the chief architect of India's nuclear program. You know, he's probably a name who doesn't pop up much outside of Indian history, although it's possible I just haven't read enough. But I guess, who was Homi Bhabha, and how central is he to this conversation about India's nuclear program?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the individuals really matter. And there are some key individuals in India's nuclear program. And definitely in the early years, Homi Jehangir Bhabha is extremely important. It's so interesting. So my book, you know, I begin with this moment in 1942 during the Second World War, when Homi Bhabha meets Vikram Sarabhai. Homi Bhabha is considered to be the father of India's nuclear program. And Vikram Sarabhai, who is a few years younger to him, is considered father of India's space program. And both of them meet at IISc, in Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore, during the Second World War in 1942. Both of them had done their degrees at the Cavendish Laboratory at the University of Cambridge, and they had returned back to the subcontinent because of the war in Europe. And obviously the war was also taking place in South Asia in a very literal way. There were battlefields of the Second World War even there. And so I think Homi Bhabha is really important, but I would say that Vikram Sarabhai, who is his successor, sort of, you know, continues many of Bhabha's projects, and they more or less agreed on many things when it came to the nuclear program and its close relationship with the space program. So Homi Bhabha was a physicist and just like Sarabhai, and after he moved back to India, British India, he was a reader, was appointed as a reader by C.V. Raman at IIC Bangalore. And there he was thinking about what to do about, he wanted to establish an Institute of Fundamental Physics while he was in Bangalore. And he was related to the Tata family, and G.R.D. Tata was not just a relative, but also he was very close to G.R.D. Tata. And so he wrote this letter to the Dorab Tata Trust asking for funds to establish an Institute of Fundamental Research in India, because there was nothing of that sort at the time. And that's what led to what is today called the TIFR, or the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research. And although it was eventually established in Bombay, you know, it was first established in Bangalore, because that's where Dasar Bhabha himself was located. And so I think he is extremely important because of his vision on the one hand, but also his ability to get the capital that he needed to materialize his vision. So in the book, I make some reference to Sheila Jasanov's and some other SDS scholars' notion of socio-technical imaginaries of the nation. So these leaders of India's nuclear program have certain imagination of what the nation would be doing with science and technology, and that vision was guiding their activities and, you know, the role that they were playing. But they also had access to financial networks, in the case of Homi Bhabha, through his connection to the Tata family, and also Sarabhai, who was, you know, was part of the Gujarati business community, and, you know, Ahmedabad is where he established the physical research laboratories before he became one of the key people of the space program, right? So these are individuals who have lofty visions on the one hand, and also access to social and financial capital, which makes a lot of difference when it comes to outcomes and consequences for the nuclear program.
So I'd like to shift to talking about more of the international dimension now. And, you know, one central program that you talk about in your book is the U.S.'s Atoms for Peace Initiative. You know, first I should ask, what was the Atoms for Peace Initiative? And then how did that relate to India's nuclear program?
The Atoms for Peace Initiative the origin was that President Eisenhower gave the speech, Atoms for Peace, in December 1953. And it was this unique moment, unique at the time, because all of a sudden he promised nuclear know-how to be available to the world, and this was very surprising to a lot of people within his own administration on the one hand, and also the world, because after the Second World War, the U.S. government did not really open up nuclear know-how, but rather closed down. And that was, you know, the U.S. Atomic Energy Act of 1946, and this category of restricted data. And I think Alex Wellerstein's book, which is called Restricted Data, you know, does a terrific job describing, you know, persistence of secrecy, wartime secrecy in post-war years. So 1953, December, was this moment, this unprecedented moment that all of a sudden, the president of the United States, that has the largest number of patents on nuclear know-how, is making it available to the world for civilian ends. And so that's the speech, and the immediate outcome of the speech in terms of policy outcomes at home in the United States was the U.S. Atomic Energy Act being amended, the 1954 Act, making it available, so allowing businesses to actually buy and sell nuclear know-how. And so it crafted this, what I call the global atomic marketplace as a consequence. And outside of the United States was the creation of the International Atomic Energy Agency, headquartered in Vienna even today. So the Atoms for Peace initiative basically created the global atomic marketplace for the first time. And as a consequence, countries like India, that prior to the initiative of Atoms for Peace, was looking for know-how but not really getting it because of various wartime secrecy and stockpiling efforts by the United States, by the British government, that persisted in post-war years. All of a sudden, countries like India were able to actually just ask for technologies and get it from countries like the UK, countries like the United States, countries like Canada. So that's what the Atoms for Peace initiative is about in terms of, you know, what it was, the vision and the policy outcome or outcomes, shall I say. Yeah.
So sticking with the geopolitical framing here, you know, it sounds like one of the big impetuses for India's nuclear program was China's successful nuclear test. And I guess, what was it about that event that really inspired, sounds like too optimistic a word, but what was it about China's nuclear test that really seemed to accelerate India's drive to make its own nuclear weapons?
Yeah, I find, you know, when I started the research many years ago, I thought it was, you know, it was just a host of reasons. And I thought, you know, Pakistan may be very important as well. But the more I delved into the archives and got a sense of what Indian policymakers were thinking, I became convinced that, you know, in these, the years that I discuss in the book, 1940s to early 1980s, so I stop early 1984, I find that the most important dimension for Indian policymakers in the region is the People's Republic of China and far less Pakistan. Pakistan is important because it's aligned with the PRC. And so coming to your question about the test, the first Chinese nuclear weapon test of October 1964, is not the first time that Indian policymakers discover that their geopolitical adversary has nuclear weapons, but it just sealed it as a reality that certainly the PRC has nuclear weapons, and there is no way that one can ignore that. And I say this that it's not the first time because I've seen archival references that Indian policymakers discussing with their American counterparts, saying that, you know, we are very concerned about Chinese nuclear weapons development, and this is prior to the nuclear test. We are worried about what this means for the fraught border between India and China. We are very concerned. And then the test happens in October 64. It's just a test. Like there are several tests that the Chinese undertake. Especially the, you know, the year 1966, there are so many tests. 1967, there's a hydrogen bomb test by the Chinese. So there are these, and then there was a satellite test in 1970. So these continuous advancement of Chinese nuclear weapons continue to make Indian policymakers very anxious, and thereby I find that, you know, their geopolitical anxieties drive to an extent keeping the nuclear weapons option open.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So one more kind of international relations, international structure, I guess, question. So India has a very strong view of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which it criticizes as colonial, as kind of what's the right word, as setting in stone the nuclear hierarchy, which India cannot become a part of. So it calls it colonial. Were those arguments? I'm going to ask, were those arguments sincere? Although I think it can be hard to kind of separate the ideology from the hard-nosed geopolitics of it. But I guess what kind of motivates that criticism? And I guess, was that criticism sincere?
You know, it's an age-old debate. And I think these questions especially, you know, what is whether it's sincere. So this question has been raised, you know, from 1968, right, when India refused to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So I would say that India's position against the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty it makes a lot of sense from the perspective of Indian policymakers, because this was a treaty that, on the one hand, allowed countries to have civilian nuclear programs, and at the same time created various checks and balances to prevent civilian programs from becoming dual purpose or becoming a military program. And I think in India's main concern from the geopolitical side of things was that the NPT could not prevent the PRC or could not contain the PRC's nuclear weapons program, because first of all, the NPT has this temporal cutoff. So all the countries that have tested within a certain period of time, that is definitely after the PRC's test of 64, they are considered nuclear weapon states. And everybody else is non-nuclear weapon states. So countries like India that has nuclear weapons is a nuclear armed state as opposed to a nuclear weapon state under the NPT. So I think it has clear hierarchies. I mean, there's just no way to say there are no hierarchies in the NPT. Quite obviously there are. It's part of the treaty, is in the text. So I don't think it's not factual that the NPT has created hierarchies. And I think from the point of view of Indian policymakers, the NPT was going to do absolutely nothing to address India's concerns of geopolitics towards the PRC. And it does come up in the archives quite a lot when Vikram Sarabhai and V.C. Trivedi, who was India's representative in Geneva at the 18 Nations Disarmament Committee that was negotiating the treaty that became the NPT, they do raise those concerns towards American interlocutors. There was these sort of a track two meetings that were taking place in India with the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, you know, based in Cambridge. I think they were headquartered in Brookline, Massachusetts at the time, but, you know, now it's in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And so they were having these discussions about how to address India's concerns towards the NPT. And over again, Indian interlocutors like Vikram Sarabhai, like V.C. Trivedi, were talking about the NPT does nothing to contain, like leave alone prevent, contain Chinese nuclear weapons program. There is not enough incentive for a country like India to sign it. And in terms of hierarchies, I mean, those are just facts in the treaty text itself.
So we finally made it to India's first nuclear test. and Pokhran in 1974. You know, I think I noticed, like, there was, I think India was obviously very proud of the nuclear test. A lot of countries were not very happy about it. I mean, especially Pakistan, but other countries as well. How does the nuclear test 1974 change the conversation about India and its nuclear program?
Yeah, that's such an important question. And I think it's far more important to reflect on, you know, the consequences of that nuclear explosion of May 1974 than the causes. I mean, I do get into the causes in the book, but I think the consequences are really important. So as you would know, and I think most of your audience would also know, that India called it a peaceful nuclear explosion. And this took place in 1974, so at the height of the oil price shocks. And, you know, what that meant in terms of framing a nuclear explosion that could potentially be used for drilling for oil. So what I'm trying to get at is, on the one hand, within India, it generated support for India's nuclear program, actually, because the Indian government, the Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, said multiple times that this is for peaceful purposes, and then Homi Sethna, who was the chair of the Atomic Energy Commission, said multiple times that this is for oil drilling. You know, we don't have oil in India. There is the oil price shock. The cost of oil is so high, it's affecting Indian agriculture, because a lot of petroleum products, you know, used for fertilizers, etc. And so it created support to the point I find like several op-eds being written at the time in places like Times of India, where Indian middle classes are actually asking for peaceful nuclear explosives to change the course of rivers. And, you know, very much like Edward Teller was writing a few years before, sitting in Livermore. So it just, within the country, at least among the middle classes, it generates support for India's nuclear program. And at a time of economic crisis, because nuclear program or nuclear explosions also are very expensive. And so to generate support for a not very productive act at a time of economic crisis is quite a political feat. So I think that's something that happened inside the country. Apart from countries like Canada that become very worried about India's nuclear program because Canadian supplied research reactor that produced plutonium was reprocessed by India in the nuclear explosive device that they made. Canada was very worried. The United States was also worried because heavy water in that Cyrus reactor was U.S. supplied. So there were all these concerns, but countries like, say, Iran, countries like Libya, all of a sudden began to look at India as, or Argentina, began to look at India as this potential supplier of nuclear know-how in a way that felt attainable. And what I mean by that is a country like Iran at the time, 74, 75, was also expanding its own nuclear energy enterprise. And it had agreements with the United States, the French, the West Germans, but the country was not getting know-how because, you know, first of all, the U.S. has very strict position against technology transfer. I think we can all agree on that. The French and West Germans were also trying to collaborate with the Iranians in a way to not give them know-how. And whereas India had demonstrated that it has the ability to conduct a nuclear explosion on its own. So clearly it knew how to do it. So it just felt like India just gave some hope to countries such as Iran, Libya, and Argentina as a potential supplier of know-how, that they would actually share know-how, unlike these other Western countries that were not. And then, of course, the very negative reaction from countries like Pakistan, understandably, because it's a geopolitical adversary, or countries like Canada, because of its own nuclear materials being involved, were also very negative. The most important international policy outcome was obviously the Nuclear Suppliers Group that was created as a response to in many ways, the NSG or the Nuclear Suppliers Group was this reversal of Atoms for Peace that we were discussing earlier. So Atoms for Peace, 1953, just, you know, opens up or creates the global atomic marketplace. And then after nuclear explosion by India of 74, these major nuclear suppliers meet in London. So at the beginning, it was called London Suppliers Conference to basically control this atomic marketplace that has gone too far, according to the suppliers. So I think those are some of the key consequences inside the country, outside the country, of the nuclear explosion of 1974.
So we're gonna jump ahead now to almost the present day. You know, I remember the conversations around the civilian nuclear deal of 2008, early 2008 was when it came into effect, negotiated between Bush and India, which helped to kind of bring India back into the fold of kind of the nuclear conversation. So kind of what role does the country play today in today's conversation about nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, since the civilian nuclear deal was signed almost, 15 years ago, I guess?
Oh, wow. Time flies. I feel so old because I also remember reading, you know, so many newspaper articles and magazine articles and op-eds about that. So what's the status today? I think, you know, the most important outcome of the U.S.-India NCA, or Nuclear Cooperation Agreement, was that that India slowly and steadily entered most of the export control regimes, like the Wassenaar Arrangement and others, except with the exception of the NSG. So at present, India is not a member of the NPT, and it's very unlikely that any Indian government will sign it. It's not a member of the Nuclear Suppliers Group or the NSG because it constantly gets Chinese opposition, but it is a member of all the other export control regimes, which sort of make up the global non-proliferation architecture, if you will. So I think the agreement made India less of an outsider, less of a pariah when it comes to the non-proliferation regime broadly construed, on the one hand. But on the other hand, you know, the big conversation, I mean, you may also remember this, Nicholas, that the big conversation was this nuclear renaissance, right? That civilian nuclear agreement with India, which is such a huge market, potentially a huge market, it's just going to lead to this global nuclear energy renaissance. Like that did not happen. A major point was obviously what happened in Fukushima a few years later, 2011. On the one hand, and the other one was this conversations around nuclear liability and the nuclear liability bill that gave several U.S. companies cold feet, and also, you know, several other companies. And I think the French and the Russians were the only ones who were willing to still talk business with India after the liability bill. So I think in terms of the nuclear renaissance, there is not much happening, as far as I understand. I mean, it's still there. I mean, there are still brochures being published because, you know, this is 2022. We're at the end of it. So it's been 10 years since Fukushima. So we're once again hearing conversations about a potential nuclear nuclear energy renaissance that's going to, you know, fix climate change, et cetera. And India might be one of the front runners of that. But those are brochures. There's not much happening in terms of, you know, actual activities. But I think the most important outcome is this: India becoming, you know, it's still an outsider because it's not a member of the NSG or the NPT, but it's far less of an outsider than it was before 2005, before 2008.
So now that we've kind of charted the path of India's nuclear development, I think this is a great place to end our conversation with Jay Sarkar, author of Plowshares and Swords: India's Nuclear Program in the Global Cold War. Jay, I actually have two more questions for you, and those are, you know, where can the standard outro questions, which are, where can people find your work, And what's next for you? What might the next project be?
Yeah, people can find my work on my website. It's my full name, joitasarkar.com. And that can link to my institutional webpage of the University of Glasgow, etc. But I think I keep my website more or less updated. So you can find most of my stuff there. I am not an avid tweeter, so I'm going to leave my Twitter handle for now. What is next for me is I'm working on my next book for Princeton University Press, which is called Atomic Capitalism, A Global History. My first book that we discussed is very much about diplomacy and politics and technology. And I don't think I had much scope, given the way I conceptualized the project, to bring the businesses in, to bring discussions of land, labor, and debt, those kinds of things that were I got very interested in. So the next project is going to be a discussion of 100-year history from 1890s to 1990s about the history of nuclear sites in the world through the lens of capitalism, specifically land, labor, and debt, focusing on everything from nuclear energy to nuclear explosion sites to uranium mining. And I'm really looking forward to working on that and finishing it and then coming back and talking about it.
Well, you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRiGordon. That's NickRiGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. This podcast is on your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us continuing to interview those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Jeff Fearnside, author of Ships in the Desert. But before then, Jay, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. It's my great pleasure. Thank you, Nicholas.